Thanks for tuning in to Crosshairs Radio episode 18. On today's show, we have Richard Sachs, the frame builder, the cyclocross team owner, and also cyclocross racer. We're also joined by Dan Chabanoff, who is on Richard's team. He is going to act as co-host during this discussion. We caught up with Richard and Dan at the U.S. Cyclocross National Championships that took place in Asheville, North Carolina, on a rainy Saturday night in Dan's hotel room. Our conversation focuses mostly on Richard's involvement as a cyclocross team owner and also as a racer. We don't really focus on the frame building aspect of that. I think there's a lot of information on the amazing work that Richard does that you can find to get more of a background on that. I really wanted to know about his experience growing up, how he got into riding bikes, how he began racing bikes, and then moving over and becoming a team owner. It's a good conversation. Thanks for tuning in. As always, please go to cxhairs.com. Check out everything there. That's how you can help me. Also, click on that shop link that is in the top right-hand corner. It's neck gaiter season. Go keep your neck warm by a Crosshairs neck gaiter or anything else that we have available in that shop. Also, follow me at CXHairs on Twitter and Instagram, and let's talk to Richard Sachs and Dan Chabanoff.
We are here in Asheville, North Carolina for the Cyclocross National Championship, and I have with me Richard Sachs, and I also have with me Dan Chabanoff, who you all have already heard from once on our show. I wanted to talk to Richard, and I think what we're going to do here today is I think most of you all know who Richard Sachs is from his bikes, from being a frame builder, and really what I'd love to do is get more of an insight to who he is in cycling, as in his race career and how he got into it and how he sort of built that passion. And I want Dan here, brought him along also, since he is on Richard's team, to sort of help out and co-host this show. And then I think we should have a pretty good conversation. So Richard, how are you doing tonight?
I'm well. Thanks for asking me over, Bill.
Yeah, so you've had an opportunity to ride this course already and to race on it. Let's just talk, since we're here, let's talk about Asheville for a little bit. You know, coming in, I know we were all a little apprehensive. What are you seeing now since you've been here for a couple days and have also raced?
It's night and day. Last week at this time, I was still part of several conversations trying to get the intel about, like, what kind of chaos we're going to be dealing with when we get here. Mainly because there were missives sent out to people that had paid parking. That was a different conversation than I think what the general public was listening in to. And those of us who had paid parking waiting for us weren't sure about the congestion, the lines, whether we'd actually get the footprint that we paid for, whether we had to pay insurance to use that footprint after the fact. So there was some ambiguity floating around, and I like to solve all those problems before I arrive because I don't really want to have problems when I'm here. So, you know, because of the internet, Facebook and those resources, you know, people could follow, you know, the questions and the comments and the opinions that some of us involved had, and then also like add their noise level to it. So it gets a little distorted. But at the end of the day, we came down on Sunday, we showed up on Monday, and from the moment I arrived at the gate, I had like no issues with anything. And I was prepared for like a Woodstock thing, lines, getting in early so that I wouldn't have to like worry about like missing a deadline or a race start. And to the minute, to the moment, everything that we wanted to do was like we were the only people here and they laid out the carpet for us. And I have to say that I was thinking about, oh my God, here we go again. And what I found was that these people have been perfect hosts.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we all sort of had that almost PTSD about it after going through Austin last year, and before it even happened, when we weren't able to get all the information we wanted, we weren't sure what was going to go down in Asheville. But I had the same experience. I got here, I had like two people in front of me in line to get a wristband, and you know, the guy in front of me actually, you know, turned around and made some joke to me, and then the woman working there made the same joke. I mean, picked up on it, and just super professional, super nice, and really, really warm and welcoming. So what about the course after coming out here and getting all your logistics set up?
Well, you know, I raced on Wednesday, so my comments now are no different than they were on Tuesday after I did a few laps. I absolutely love the course. And to be fair, when I got here and did my first recon lap at slow motion before anybody was really here, I thought, geez, I'm going to kill myself. I felt like when I got after the off cambers at Heckle Hill, somehow got down that without killing myself, and the first thing I saw was that dirt downhill. I thought, I am really out of my skill set, because, you know, like, I race cross all the time, but I know what my limits are, and, like, I thought in the first 40 or 50 seconds, well, actually, once you go through the barn and then go up Heckle Hill and back around again and do the dirt sections and the downhills, from that little subsection, I thought, this is where I say to my wife, you know, like, I'm not going to race. And then perhaps she's going to say to me, well, like, we came all this way. I mean, I'm making up this conversation because it may never have happened. But after I did the second lap and the third and the fourth and got a feel for it, it's like, man, this is, well, the word awesome is overused, but this is such an awesome course. And it's a real, I didn't think anybody would be going over this course in more than groups of two or three. I thought, like, groups are not going to happen, big groups. It's going to be ones and twos, maybe threes at the most. But it's really going to separate early, and probably people are going to get pulled. But that's not my problem.
Right, yeah. I even see it as, and just looking at it and thinking about what's going to happen with the elite races, when you come off the start and you do that first off camber near the bike barn, that was the place that it really, because you still had a big group in there, and if you rode that clean, it sort of set you up for the rest of the race.
Yeah, I think that's just the way, you know, the game is played. There's only one line or maybe two lines through some of those sections. So you get a chance by your ranking to be in the first, second, or third row, or maybe capitalize on a mistake that somebody up there is going to make and try to have a clean start in the first minute or so. Just turn yourself inside out and just hope that you make a separation, because, like, I've seen enough of these races throughout all the seasons to know that once it happens on a course like this, there's no coming back. A course like Gloucester, which is more like flat and fast, I mean, you could make up for a few mistakes and maybe gain back 20 or 30 seconds, but, you know, early in the race, but I think this race basically will shape up in the first three quarters of lap one.
Yeah. So, how many national cyclocross events have you been to?
I think I've been to all of them except one since maybe 96. I went to the Worlds in 1972, so I'm telling you that so that you know I have some history that goes back before cyclocross was cool. When I lived in England as a teenager, cyclocross wasn't a niche event. It was simply what you did when the road season ended. Just like time trialing was a pretty common thing to do for most road racers, cyclocross was also common. So we used to go to all the races on the weekends, and the Worlds were in Crystal Palace, I think, in January, or maybe it was December. I forget the way the calendar ran back then. But, you know, I saw de Vlaeminck win, I think, was his seventh of seven world championships. And it would be wrong of me to say that I was struck then by the cyclocross, Cupid, but it never left me. We had riders on our team through the 70s and 80s that were racing cross. It just wasn't a developed niche in our country until maybe the middle 90s.
Well, since we're back in 1972, let's even start you know, from the beginning for you, how did you get into cycling? How did you get into racing?
Well, you don't have enough time for that, but I'll try to make it short. When I was, I believe, 17 and I got my license, I think it was in New Jersey, 17 was the age then, I expected to get a car, because without a car, what good is a license? So I was a little bit beside myself when I realized that there's no way I was going to get a vehicle. And I tell the story enough to sound repetitive in my own mind. I kind of felt like, well, what the hell is, like, you know, like, if I can't get a car, then I want X. And the X I presented was like a laundry list of like commodities that I felt would be a way to kind of get even for not getting that car that I thought I deserved. And on that laundry list of things was a bicycle. Now, why it was on that list, I can't remember. That's way too long ago. But I remember having a friend named Jimmy Farmer in Bayonne, where I grew up. And he always rode a bike. He rode like an upright bar, three-speed with a basket. And I always thought, Jimmy Farmer's a cool guy. Maybe if I get a bike, I'll be a cool guy like Jimmy Farmer. So a bicycle made that list. So my mom said to me, okay, we'll get you a bike. But we didn't really have a target. We ended up getting a bike. The bike happened to be a 10-speed. It happened to have Campagnolo, like, entry-level parts. This was maybe 1969. The needle got in my arm really quickly after that, and I started subscribing to bicycle magazines, started looking at pictures of racers, started to think about life as a European rider. Oh, and by the way, I never had any aspirations to race professionally or go to Europe to race. But the fantasy of, like, looking at a photo of a Merckx or somebody from that generation and feeling like I could mimic that on my, like, $99 10-speed was something that just came out of nowhere and stuck. So that's the seed that I planted, or was planted in me, that became this.
Do you remember your first race?
I do. Well, actually, when I was living in Vermont as an 18-year-old, racing really wasn't that popular up there, but we used to do this weekly time trial called the Cheeseboro Circuit. The Cheese Factory Circuit. And at that time, I was already on my fourth bicycle in maybe 5 or 6 years. I had a custom-made English bicycle named by a fellow named Bill Hurlow. And every Tuesday night, I'd get on my good wool shorts and my good wool jersey and my good Detto Pietro shoes. And, you know, this is funny, you know, I don't really talk about this anymore, but once a week I would peel off. First of all, there was no such thing as racing clinchers back then. So once a week I would peel off the entry level, or the low cost Pirelli tubulars that were on my bike 5 days a week, and re-glue on the good tubulars that Pirelli made, because there was no Clement that we could get back then, for that evening. And then on Wednesday, maybe, or Thursday, peel them back off and blah, 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 blah. This would go on all summer. And then we got wind of, there's this road race in Stowe, up Smuggler's Notch. It was a 40-mile event. And the concept of a road race was like a foreign language to me, but I had a license. We just didn't have anything to do with licenses back then, because there was no races. This was, I think, 1971. So I decided, well, I'm going to do the Stowe Road Race. And I never rode in a road race before. I mean, I'd ridden in groups, training rides, but nothing tactically, team tactics, lead outs, draft. None of that stuff was even, like, in my head, even though, like, I had been reading the magazines for a number of years. So I did that race, and that kind of was, you know, the next step. You know, it wasn't like from that point forward I became a road racer, but that was my first ever event with a lot of people elbow to elbow, at least for the first couple of miles.
So where does it go from there after that first race?
Well, I had, like, a parallel life. I was in boarding school. I graduated in June. I wanted to be a writer. I didn't get into the first four colleges that I applied to. So the second three included Franconia and Goddard, which back then were two very artsy, anti-war era type colleges, and I thought, great, I got into Goddard. I'm going to have a lot of fun. I'm going to do a lot of acid and have a lot of relationships, because really, to me, that's what college was about, or it would have been about. And the funny thing is, after not getting into the first four colleges, which is where I really wanted to go, Goddard still kind of was cool, but they couldn't accept me in September. So they said, we have overbooked, you're in for April. So if you think about it, I had from June or July of graduating through the next April, and I had a job in New York City stocking shelves at the Empire State Building, and I was simply going to ride it out until April. Then one day I saw an ad in the Village Voice, which used to come out every Wednesday, and I used to get it every Wednesday anyway, and as a coincidence, just a fate, I saw an ad for a mechanics job in Vermont. So without even calling them, I took a Greyhound bus to Vermont. Next day I walked in and I said, I'm here for the job. So, you know, they looked at me like, what are you, nuts? The job's been filled for months. And you have to think about it, this is 1971 or so. So the insertion that they paid for in Vermont for a New York City area newspaper included the contract, you know, for the period of time that they paid for it. So it had been running. I had just never seen it before. So I showed up in Vermont and like, who are you? And it's like, I wasn't even qualified. I was just some guy with a couple of tools and an enthusiasm for bikes, with a 10-speed bike. And so anyway, it was a one-way ticket that I took to Vermont. I didn't get the job. I ended up living in a flop house called the Wilson Hotel, which now probably is a boutique hotel. And Burlington now is no longer the, you know, the dump that it was in 1971, but it was when I lived there. So I got a job working at the Blodgett Oven Factory in Burlington, working by the day, thinking that, oh man, I've hit rock bottom, because at least I'll start college in April, but here I am with a one-way ticket, and like, I'm supposed to be like, you know, like a young kid from the suburbs who, you know, shouldn't be suffering this kind of misfortune.
Can I ask what you're doing at the oven factory?
I have no idea. I wasn't eating any of the pizza. You know, it's probably like punching rivet guns or something. But, you know, I got in my head that I was so upset with myself for putting all of my opportunity in jeopardy by like leaving New York and like thinking that I could go to Vermont on a Greyhound bus and get a job and leave that job in April to start college. I went to the University of Vermont with a notebook in my hand, and I had this like, I'm going to get even with these guys for not giving me that job. And I wrote away to about 30 different people in England who said they make bikes. And I said to them in my handwritten pencil, spiral notebook, stationery, that I want to come over and learn how to make bikes in return for working for free. Because in my head, getting rejected for that job that I had no right applying for in the first place, the only way to get even or redeem myself for that kind of shame was to learn how to make bikes. Because in my mind, then, making bikes would make things cooler than fixing bikes. Now, if you said to me now, or even like a year later, where did that come from? I have no idea. Because I didn't even understand what the concept making bikes meant. I just felt like I screwed up. I ended up in Vermont. I have this adventure. It's cool and everything, because it was like those anti-war years when people had maybe looser boundaries. So I had fun, don't get me wrong. But I also felt like there's a certain streak of irresponsibility that I was riding on that I wasn't happy with for myself, whether it was the self-esteem. So I figured I got to redeem this.
I got to ask, did you ever go back to that bike shop after you were like a frame builder that was selling under your own name, and we're like, ha.
Oh yeah, I have a long history with it. It's a ski rack in Burlington who now is in a different location completely from where they were, but temporarily, I ended up with a job there until so I sent all these letters to people in England anyway before I ended up with this job temporarily. Mm-hmm. And of all the ones I sent, I got one reply saying, yeah, come on over. So in the middle of working for these people in Vermont for a few months, I was also preparing for the sojourn to London because I, in the meantime, also wrote to Goddard and said, look, I have to go away for a while, so can I postpone my entrance until like X? And I don't remember if X was like 12 months forward or whatever, but they said no problem. So I ended up going to England. I worked at the ski rack for a few months, went to England, lived there, extended my stay there, and got completely immersed in that culture. And from that point forward, I never set foot in a classroom again. When I came back, I had this far-fetched scheme to perhaps take my experience in England, write to Goddard and say, hey, in return for teaching a class in bicycle making, I would like to propose that you give me free tuition. And they didn't, I don't know where this stuff comes from, but it was like, this came out of me like it was like.
Sounds like a great idea to me, honestly.
It sounded like a great idea to me at the time, but mind you, I'd only been there for like a year or maybe 10 months, and I didn't know jack shit about bike making, because you only skim the surface in that short amount of time. So where I was going to get the resources to teach a course, that doesn't make sense either. But luckily for everything and everybody, they said no. I ended up getting a job with the American branch of the family business that I was working for in London. And the rest is, you know, where I am
so
since.
Let's connect that back to you racing. You know, did you race in England at all? Or?
I did, yeah. Not successfully because I didn't really have the tools or the mindset, but I did enter all the races and, you know.
You just kind of banged your head against the wall?
Well, I didn't really have any aspirations. I was, I think, for a long time as a racer, more about posing than actually competing. I mean, I liked putting on the outfit. I liked having a really nice bike that worked efficiently. I liked having good equipment. But I wasn't so much an athlete as I was a bike geek. That changed over time, but yeah, I really wasn't in the race to race. I was in the race because I thought it would be a cool atmosphere to be part of.
Is that what, you know, being part of that atmosphere, is that kind of why you moved over to the side of running teams? Because you...
Oh, no.
No?
Long before I realized that, you know, eventually I got a clue and learned how to race and I learned how to train and I learned, you know, what it meant to do well, you know, I didn't spend my amateur, not that I was a professional, but I didn't spend my formative years as an amateur, like getting dropped from the fourth and fifth and sixth group. I was eventually able to put things together. Mm-hmm. But when I finally quit road racing the first time, which was maybe 1979 or so, I had a couple of years when I didn't really do much. And then a friend of mine who was racing in the same club as I was proposed to me that I should use my business and become a sponsor of the club because they had already run through like a long list of sponsors through most of the 70s and maybe I could take over. So that was where this all began.
So what year was that?
It's a little bit vague to me, but I'd say 1981. At least, because by 1982, we were like already on red bikes. Mm-hmm. And I believe there was at least one year before that, that the bikes were steel gray and we didn't really have any kind of agenda. It was just you, meaning the guy who first broached the idea to me. You find the riders, I'll make the bikes. You find the clothes, you find everything else. I'm basically the bike maker. And then after that, it became... Well, you know, I shared in the responsibilities and it became my responsibility. They moved on. And before you know it, it was like, you know, it evolved into a full-fledged road team, which eventually became a full-fledged cross team.
How did that transition happen?
Oh, organically. You know, everybody that was racing at the front of all the events for most of the 80s got older. you know, the it just happens. You know, they quit racing, their interest level wanes, the pool of bodies to replenish them perhaps was maybe not as deep as it could have been. So eventually, you know, we had like a category 1-2 team or a pro 1-2 team. It became a Masters team, which back then, Masters 35 racing was a big deal. I don't really know much about it now.
So still a pretty big deal, I think.
Well, maybe now, but I don't really follow it. But I'm just saying that we became like an older version of what we were in the 80s. So for the end of the 80s and for the first few years of the 90s, primarily this group was a Masters team. That Masters team eventually rolled itself into another Masters team, and we combined the few Cat 1s and national level riders that we had into a super team. And that group lasted about 3 years before I kind of felt it doesn't really have legs. So I went back to running things again by 94. So for a while there, CYBC, which is really the backbone of all of this, set stands for Connecticut Yankee Bicycle Club. On paper, that's the club that we all belong to. For a while there, that we had merged. And then by 94, I kind of took it back and decided to run things a certain way. And we kind of resuscitated what we had for most of the 80s.
So, sorry.
Oh, no, I was going to say, when you say run things a certain way, what does that entail? What philosophically did you want to do?
Well, first of all, it was always homegrown. It was always, and I use this word again, organic. I wasn't into cherry picking riders from other teams. I thought that's like among the most despicable things anybody could do, by the way. And I kind of felt like fortunate that we always had a good group of people from which we could field a good, formidable Cat 1, Cat 2 team. Back then, I think Cat 1, Cat 2 was almost what Division 3 is now. I'm kind of vague on all these classifications, but there really wasn't a pro class to speak of. And if you were a Cat 1, 2 back then, you probably raced as much for as much money and as often as maybe a D3 guy would do now. And
who was what year and who was on it was the you'd feel like was the first year of the current iteration of the team?
Well, the current iteration of a team is a true cyclocross team. And back then, I have a lot of memories, and some of them had to do with our first year that we actually got a whole pile of cash. And when I finally saw that check, I thought, my God, this is wonderful, because a company had entrusted me to take their money and run a team so that everybody involved could have a better support system. And that really was about 1987. But, you know, those people got older. That morphed into something else. Then for a while, I was running my team, which was a CYBC-based team, and also supporting the Nexa team, which for most of the 90s was a developmental team that spawned a lot of national national with a capital N team riders that rode our bikes and were supported by our, you know, sponsorship program. So I basically had two teams that I was supporting, my own and this Nexa team. The Nexa team eventually morphed into something else, and by that time the CYBC thing didn't really have anything left. So I proposed to the Nexa people, why don't you become me, meaning let me do the paperwork with USAC, or back then it was USCF. You become CYBC, and all the sponsors and riders you have become members of CYBC. So we did that for about 6 or 7 years, and Trek was a sponsor of the women's team. I was a sponsor of the men's team. We had youngsters, juniors, U23s, whatever, and you know, for maybe 4 or 5 years, going through perhaps, I'm trying to think now, if it was 2003, 2004, I was still trying to juggle sponsoring a men's team on the road and a multi-gender team in cross. And eventually, like, I said, screw it. You know, like, I hate road. I've been doing road for 30 plus years. I just hit the wall big time, and I never looked back, because our first involvement with Cross was maybe 1996 or so, and that kind of turned into what we have now. Part of it has to do with Adam and Meyerson. Part of it has to do with the Nexa team and the successes that those kids had. We had the first year that, you know, I supported their team, we had at least three or four national champions. And it was like, whoa, this is awesome. And I always felt like going to a cross race was like a festival. It was like fun. It was like people were having a great time. The attention span was shorter. You didn't see people just once every hour when they came around on a corner and waited for the finish. Like, cross seemed to be like the perfect storm of racing, atmosphere, time of year, bang for your buck as far as branding and sponsorship. And I just like had no problem turning my back on road and never looking back again.
Yeah, it's really the community too of cyclocross, and it seems like it's everybody's still competitive, everybody still wants to win, but you know, they hang out after the race, they watch their friends race, and everybody's really into it, which you know, I just don't think you get that same atmosphere on the road. I mean, that's what attracted me personally. That's why I'm attracted to cyclocross. And you're right, the short attention span is huge. It's great to be able to have the races over, you know, under an hour, and also see everybody.
You know what I like, Bill, is that you can stand there in almost any part of a good venue and see most of the race,
yeah.
Or at least walk, you know, across the meadow and see the other part that you can't see. And I think as far as like getting the community involved, if you're like invading their personal space for the weekend and they're wondering, what are you doing in my park, and they see it, it's like, oh, yeah, of course, there are rare incidents like Austin last year, but for the most part, you can't see a cross race and not be compelled to think, oh, I gotta watch this. This is like the most incredible thing I've ever seen. Of course, if you're a cross racer, it's a no-brainer. But if you're just some person from the community, I think it's easy to get those people into the fold once they see an event, because it's like they can take their kids, they can walk around, they can make noise.
Yeah, and that's, you know, when Dan came down for the race that I promote, TCCX, this was the first year we saw this, that we had it routed in a way that it was almost like, I don't follow golf much, but it reminds me of like the Masters, and that people were running from one section to another, sort of following everyone around, and then it was just these cheers from each, you know, obstacle around the course. And it's, you know, that's unique. You don't get that in other types of
racing.
One
of the most enjoyable parts for Deb, my wife, and I when we're at events is when we're not working the pits and we're getting ready, or we have a few moments between events that are not our team's, you know, classification. We don't overtly people watch, but we can't help but to watch the kids running around on their little bikes, pretending that they're the people that are within the ribbons, or the, you know, the tape, or the families pushing the strollers, and everybody just having a good time. You never see anybody at across the event that looks like they're being held hostage. You know, it's like everybody wants to be there, and everybody like thinks, oh, I wish this didn't have to end at 3:30 and I have to get back in my car and do the traffic thing, because like it's a wonderful experience.
Right. So going back to the team, so now that you had done this for a while and you sort of put road to the side and moved over to cyclocross and sort of taken over back over your own team, what do you look for? What are you trying to get out of from your team? What are you looking for in the people that you want to bring on, and what experience do you want?
The reason I started sponsoring, one of my friend Martin first asked me to come back to the club that we're all part of and like lend myself to it as a supporter, was because all through my better years as a racer, which seems like a complete eternity in arrears from now, I was supported well, and I kind of felt, okay, now I will support. That beginning in 1981, 1982, I mean, I didn't really have an agenda, and I didn't have a plan, and I didn't have if I don't get to this point in time, I'm going to pull the plug. None of that stuff was even part of my personal conversation. Before you know it, a generation passes, a decade passes, new people come in, and you think, what's going to happen when these people get older? And what's going to happen to this program that we have? And by some twist of fate, younger people come in. And then, like I said again, before you know it, it's like you're in the 90s. And of course, some of the boundaries get pushed back and some of the standards change, but you are essentially a full-time, meaning for whatever the season's duration is, you are part of a larger whole that involves your business, other people's lives, their goals, their dreams, the responsibility that you take being the, what's the word I'm looking for? You have to take care of other people's, you know, budgets who have entrusted them to you in return for some, like, exposure for their product, you know, whatever it happens to be. So it just, time passes, and then you realize, oh my God, you know, we've been doing, and like, I'm 62. I'm older than a lot of the parents of the people we sponsor. When we started, I was like a peer age-wise, and it's like I still think of everybody as like somebody who's my peer rather than somebody who's like somebody who could be my child or my offspring or somebody who I'm friends with is, you know, their children. And it's like I don't really look at it as like there's no master plan. The thread that runs through most of it or maybe all of it is that I was supported when I raced. Now I support when they race. Over time, thanks to the successes of a lot of the racers, and of course the internet somehow blows some of the successes out of proportion, but we'll take what we have, we've become much larger than I think we really are. It's just me and my wife and I, and like maybe 18 or 20 brands that work together to support a team. The team, you know, Dan Chabanoff's been on it for 5 years now. Britley's been with us for four. The other two, Sam O'Keefe and Libby White, are first-year riders with us. We've had riders spend their entire racing careers with us until they become either parents on their own account or too old to continue racing full-time. And we only take on a new rider when somebody else retires. This year, in all fairness, we took on one more rider because we had a new sponsor come on and the budget allowed me to afford another, you know, warm body. So things worked out really swell for us in 2015. But my ideal is to have a support system that backs me and trusts me with their money, and then to spend that money on people who I feel are good ambassadors for everything that we do. And I have this like little triangle that I ring whenever this conversation comes up. We have three important things that I feel are much more important than anything else we do. We want to help each other achieve our personal racing goals. In other words, you are there primarily to sacrifice yourself so that your teammate could do better. I mean, you know, it sounds a little dramatic, but I really feel that way. We are there to give good brand, which means for all the people that give us money and tires and wheels and helmets and shoes and clothes and whatever if they give us X, we should bleed so that they get X plus or X times, you know, 2 or X times exponential, so that they feel their investment in us is legitimate and pays back. To be honest, I've never had somebody give me anything, money or product, with a stipulation that if you don't get on the podium or if you don't win races or if you don't show up in the news stories, it's over. So I feel like over time I've earned their trust to run a good group. So, yeah, giving good brand is paramount. And then the last part of it is to make memories. Because I feel like, you know, like, I think this is a fun thing to do, but it is not life. As much as I, like, bleed for cyclocross and I'm a zealot for, you know, promoting our team and all the people that support it, I do feel like it's not, it shouldn't take over what your real life is. You should have your life between the margins of Monday morning and Friday afternoon, and then also be fit enough when you show up on Saturday to race and turn yourself inside out, and to have the best possible time you can with your teammates and with Deb and I and Buddy, and just giggle and like take pictures and crack up and like all that kind of stuff. And my feeling is like if you make each race, each weekend, all 4 or 5 months long, a moment that you wish lasted forever, then that's a success. Because nothing lasts forever, and before you know it, Monday comes around and your real lives take over. Now, don't get me wrong. There's not a switch that gets flicked on Monday for me, because I might take a week off between the Nationals and planning everything for next year. But running this thing is a labor of love, and it's a full-time job. And I think a lot of parts of my life get put on hold or don't evolve at all because this is so important to me.
That was going to be my question, because you are known as a frame builder.
Yeah.
And where is this team in your list of priorities now? Is that now just feeding the frame building part? Is that secondary to this team?
No, my frame building business is a completely separate entity from... I mean, you know, it's seen as, you know, Richard Sachs Cycles and Richard Sachs Cyclocross Team and the clothing and the cyclocross bikes. But the irony might be that I don't really make a lot of cross bikes. I mean, I have made a lot of cross bikes, but my business, what I get paid for is to make road bikes, because my background is in road. And while I do feel like I have a good foundation to know what goes where on a cross bike, I don't really consider myself an expert. I mean, I'm not, you know, new to it, and I'm not going to make a bike that turns to the left when you want to lean to the right, but...
Rides pretty good, according to my opinion.
Well, that works. I think we can just end the conversation right there, because that's the last word. But yeah, the funny thing is, I make road bikes. What I know inside and out, up and down, front and back, are road bikes. I do it intuitively. Sizing, frame design, etc. Cross bikes, you know, I've been doing since the 70s. It's nothing new. I have no problem making them. But for all the signal to noise that comes with the cross team, I make precious few cross bikes compared to what I do in my real life, which is make bikes for my road bike customers.
So, moving back to your own racing at a 60 plus race category now, what are your goals? How has your training changed over time? You know, just you personally, what do you do now as far as training and racing, and what are you looking to get out of it?
Well, I do a lot of fantasizing, because I had a couple. First of all, when I started racing cross myself, it was only 2002, because I had been supporting my group and simply showing up on the weekends after my own road season ended and just doing all the things necessary to keep things floating. I broke my leg, I think it was 2001. I came back, you know, I gained like 30 pounds, like everything in my life atrophied. I had like the season off. I thought, you know, like maybe I'll start doing this cross thing. You know, like I'm done riding road anyway. So I got myself a cross bike. I started, I think, 2002 was my first full season. I couldn't turn, I couldn't lean, I couldn't get off the bike, I couldn't get on the bike. Because for as long as I've been around cyclocross, I didn't have the first skill. And I didn't have anybody tell me what to do. The first couple of years was just basically me falling and getting lapped and like thinking, man, I'm making a real asshole out of myself in front of the public. And my name is on my shirt, and my name is on my bikes. It's a good thing that we have fast people on my team, because otherwise this would be a complete shit show. And before you know it, maybe by the end of the decade, I started being able to put things together, and I was like, I was doing well. I mean, you know, like when I talk about the fantasizing, like I had like two or three good years as a, I think it was a middle 55-year-old.
And people, 2010, I remember that was before I was on the team, but I remember because I was like following you pretty closely.
Yeah.
I think you were predicted to like win that year.
Yeah, and in then, all fairness,
I think that might have been the year where you were the number one ranked USAC rider.
I was. Let me repeat that for the people in the...
That was pretty good.
Yeah, it's like, you know, the algorithm was kind of screwed up, so I'll give them that. However, it was the algorithm that they used, and I didn't even know that the USAC had a ranking system, and somehow I stumbled on a page on my login that showed everything. And, like, I have screenshots of it because, to me, it's like, you know, that is as good as it's going to ever be for me. I wasn't simply ranked first in the country for 55-year-olds. I was, like, the highest-ranked rider in the country over 35 to 99 based on the races that I rode, who I beat when I raced them, etc. I don't even know what that shit means, and I don't even care. But it's like you can't erase that.
Right.
And that fueled me to like go better. I think I won 5 or 6 races in 2009, a few more, maybe 2010. And then before you know it, like everybody else gets in my age group. And yeah. Like I'm getting on the...
Yeah, I think it was 2000.
Not the windshield.
Yeah, I think I remember. I think maybe the first time I saw you at a race was probably Grenoble.
I won that.
Exactly.
Oh, it was treacherous conditions.
It was 2009.
And it's like, I didn't even know I won. It's like I came across the line and Sailing was doing the announcing and my wife said, you won. And it's like, I knew I put in a good effort. And like back then, it's like, I mean, like I'm 62 now. So like I think about it, it's like if I was 57 now, then a 56, you know, I still had some fight in my legs and I still like was skinny and like had muscle tone and a good tan line and all the things that are important to a bike racer. And I remember thinking like, this is like the second or third coming of my racing life because this is where I'm going to take this.
You know, this is all good for me to hear because I just turned 47. So I feel like, okay, I can get back in shape now and still be okay until at least I'm 56. And then it's going to fall apart.
You just got to wait until they start doing the age-graded single-speed national championships. There you go. I saw that new bike, Bill.
It is nice. Yeah, Mike Zancanato built me a single-speed bike.
Oh, good for you. Yeah. But anyway, you know, time has a way of showing you what reality is about. And like for me, it's like I the same thing happened to me on the road. I had really good years. I was a 35 plus master racer, and like I won races. I was really feeling good. I was arrogant, you know. I had all that kind of confidence that you need to have when you get on the starting line and you're gonna like, I don't care who's here, this is my place, I belong here. And then before you know it, like a year or two goes by and like you're doing it on vapors because you think, well, this shit never fades. And before you know it, it's like you're 10th place, you're 21st place, and like everybody else takes your place. And that's what happened to me at least by 2011, 2012. So when I say that my training is based on fantasy, it's like I still see myself as the person who's capable of having good rides. But, you know, I got to really turn myself inside out and like capitalize on everybody's misfortune to even like see the front of the race at this point. And it's a little frustrating, but that's the reality.
So have you ever worked with a coach, or you just do this all on your own,
try to figure it out? I've never had a coach. I've never had a device. I don't even own a cell phone. I've never used an Avocet or a Cat Eye or a power meter. Basically, I go out there and I pretend I'm somebody else. I think maybe pretending that I'm myself from 2008 is no longer a good idea, but you know, that's what I do. I to tell you the truth, Bill, I don't really care that much. It's a big game for me. It's no different than when I was really new and living in Vermont, and you put on the nice jersey and the nice shorts and you pretend you're Eddie Merckx for a couple of hours. Like, yeah, I mean, I'd like to do well. I'd like to do well again and have people see me at the front of a race and not because I'm being lapped by the people who are really leading the race. But, you know, I have to run my job. I have my family. You know, we have responsibilities that have nothing to do with bike racing that have to be tended to. And as much as I, you know, obsess about my results, you know, I know that I'm not going to be branded based on how I finish a race anymore. Yeah. And I finally reconciled with that roughly a year or so ago. It's like my self-esteem had been tied for a long time to how I raced on the weekend, and then I finally let go.
Yeah, I struggled with that for a while as well, and actually had not raced since 2012 and finally raced again this year. My self-esteem took a big hit from actually being out there. I'd say it's more participating than racing, but, you know, I'm sort of reconciling those same things and trying to get back into it and, like, just having fun.
Yeah.
But still working hard and still trying to, you know.
Yeah.
So considering we're talking in Asheville the night before Sunday, do you guys want to do any prognostications?
You know, it will be interesting because most likely people will already know. So they'll be able to listen to this and then see how we did. So what do we have? We have 2 U23 races. You want to do those? And then the men's and women's elite?
Sure. I don't know, Richie, you want to?
Well, I'll take a stab at it because as much time as I spend around cross and as many times a year as I see all the guys who are the contenders, I don't really follow them past the fact that I know their names and can put their names and their faces together in a picture. I'd have to say, based on this course and my notion that anything could happen, especially since of the weather tonight is going to change it tomorrow, based on the fact that anything could happen, I will predict that Dan Timmerman has like a killer ride, and I would like to see him win.
That's a great prediction. I like that.
I think he could ride with anybody in the country. And I think that, you know, if like shit happens and he capitalizes on it, maybe he could just take the race to somebody else and that other person could have a hard time playing, you know, make up. I also feel like Jonathan Page has always been a favorite of mine. He rode with us for 3 years, and even when he moved on, we stayed friends. And I love seeing, he won his first nationals with us and then two more after that, and ever since that third nationals that he won, I've wanted him to see him win a fourth, and he's come close. I'd love to see him win tomorrow.
Yeah, can I just say, you know, that says a lot that the two guys that you mentioned are guys who once raced for you,
yeah,
but no longer do, yet you're still, you know, cheering for them.
Oh, completely behind. I mean, Dan's only not raced for us for a few months now, so it's not like, you know, a lot of time has passed since, you know, we cut that cord, but he's in a good place. We've remained friends, and there's nothing to do with, you know, anything except, you know, times and things change, but we completely relate on all levels. But Paige has always been my, the thing is, he gave up everything. And there are people that have opinions about that he should have done it, he shouldn't have done it, he did it the wrong way, he gave up too much going to Europe. You know, he could have had all of it if he just stayed here and, like, cashed in on, like, winning everything all the time the way Jeremy and some of the others do now. But he just walked away from it, and he just started his life there. And he raised a family there, and he's at the end of his career. And on a good day, he could still race at the front and win.
Oh, yeah, and it's going to be nasty tomorrow, and he's a guy that excels in those conditions.
You know, the term I use lately is mind palace, because we're big Sherlock Holmes fans, and we like when the star of the show talks about going into the mind palace. And it's like, I think whoever goes into the mind palace the deepest and soonest is going to win. You know, he's not going to make any mistakes. The mistakes are going to be made by the people chasing him. So we shall see.
All right. Well, yeah. Since we're talking men's race, you're actually going to get a front row seat at that, Dan. What do you...
Fourth row seat, technically.
well put.
Yeah, I checked the call-up sheet. I wanted to know what seat I was getting. But, yeah, I mean, if it's raining now, or I think it was...
Yeah, it's definitely moist out there.
Yes.
Absolutely.
But at the same time, it was kind of raining overnight. And, you know, by the time I did my pre-ride this morning at 11:40, it was dry.
Right.
So this course, sections of it aren't going to get dry, but a lot of it dries out pretty fast.
Yep.
So it's hard to, you know, it's going to have to keep raining for it to be muddy. And I don't know. Yeah, I mean, the person that wins is going to be the person that doesn't make a mistake, because this course is just, there's not really anywhere to make up time. There's only places to lose time. So it's going to be a game of elimination. I think the first lap we'll see like six guys, and then the next lap we'll see four guys, and then the next lap we'll see three guys, and then you know, the guys are going to make mistakes. And
Names.
It's hard to bet against Powers, because he comes across as a guy that is meticulous and doesn't make mistakes. You know, he's somebody that is very, you know, he controls his environment, he controls everything that he can, and he eliminates things that can work against him. So in the situation where I think how the race set will play out, whereas going to be people making mistakes, it's hard to bet against them. But if it's dry, if it's fast, it's hard to bet against Steven. There's a long straight line with some barriers, and then an uphill sprint after the final technical descent. And if Steven's there, I think he can outsprint Jeremy.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's done it once before. I mean, you know,
Jeremy doesn't race well in Louisville.
I was going to say he hasn't won there in.
And he had some really bad luck. I think he flatted like, I talked to him after that, and I think he flatted like six wheels over those 2 days, you know, and like people really blew that, him being beat by Steven out of proportion.
Oh, I agree. Absolutely.
And, you know, it was great for Steven, but it was by no means a changing of the guard. I mean, Jeremy is still 100% the guy to beat, and if Steven can pull it off tomorrow, that would, you know, that would be a bigger signal, but
yeah,
it's still, you know, this is the thing about nationals. It's one race, right? Whether, you know, for a guy like Jeremy and a guy like Steven, if they win nationals, that's going to make or break their season.
Right.
But for the rest of us, you know, fighting for a top 20, top 15, a top 10, you know, it's icing on the cake, but at this point, you already know if you've had a good or a bad season.
Right. Yeah, I think, you know, you got Logan Owen, who is really the other guy in that mix, but I think that Hyde and Powers are going to do everything they can early on to make sure that Owen's not around if they can. And from
that's going
to
be tough. He's good.
Oh yeah, no, I know, but what I mean is they're not going to be like burning any matches attacking each other if he's still there,
right?
until they can get rid of him, because yeah, he's definitely a threat. Hyde has really good skills in the technical stuff, really good descender. I'll tell you the interesting thing, and I don't know if this will play out, just watching practice today, Danny Summerhill.
I was going to say in those descents, count that guy out. Woo,
he was surprising how smooth and how fast he was riding the technical parts. So, but all that being said, I'm sticking with Powers.
All right. Can anybody bet against Katie Compton?
Well, I think it's Katie versus Katie. You know, those are the two we're looking at.
I saw Katie Antoniou pre-riding today. She looked good. She was trying different lines on that descent off the, what do they call? All right, I'm having a hard time with this. Heckle Hill is the long straight one, or is it the switchback one?
Heckle Hill is the switchbacks. Bonkbreaker Hill is the other one. And then the Cane Creek Forest is the one that's after the stepped off camber.
Mm.
Yeah.
All right, whatever. I was watching her.
I just had a two-hour production meeting where all of this was spelled out.
Okay, all right. Well, I'm glad you know, because I, up until that point, had no idea. But yeah, Antonou looked really good trying different lines and off Heckle Hill. Sorry. Through the cask descent.
Into the woods.
These things are so forced, but you know what? They paid the money they deserve.
Absolutely. We can't give them too hard of a time. They're making it possible.
Exactly. I without Logan Racing, I have no idea who's even starting the U23 men.
He's in the elites.
Right. U23 men is going to come down to Curtis White, Drew Dillman, and Tobin Ortenblad.
You know, I met Tobin this year at Providence. He's a really funny kid. I would be stoked to see him win. But, you know, I love the Whites. The first team I rode for, Elites and Nycross, Curtis and Emma were on that team. So, I got to pick Curtis for this one just because there's some, like, crossed paths there. I mean, I remember when Curtis was, like, when he was like a scrawny little kid. And so like whenever I see him now as this like 6 foot something muscular.
He is a big dude.
Yeah,
kid.
He grew. Holy shit. I'd be really happy to see Curtis or Tobin win. U23 women, I think it's just the Emma and Ellen show.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, I don't know any of the other names that are gonna make the cash register there. It's basically Emma and Ellen.
I think there, you know, this is not to discount Emma's skills because she definitely has them, but I think Ellen may have a little bit of advantage in the skills department, but then Emma has an advantage in the power department.
I hate to say it, but there's really not a lot of places to put power down on this course. I know.
It's that final stretch, isn't it? And that's really it.
I mean, but here's the thing. It's like the way that, you know, every time I ride in the field, every stretch of the field feels slightly downhill to me.
Yeah. So
for whatever reason, it feels like you can carry a lot of speed.
That just means you're riding well, Dan.
All right, whatever. Thanks for that. I don't know if there's a lot of places to really put power down on this course. So I don't know. It's hard to bet against somebody. You know, whoever can descend off that Heckle Hill thing.
Yeah,
you can gain 5 seconds there on somebody that's not doing it well very easily. It's going to be big gaps. I'm just kind of hoping that I'll be able to ride it on the first lap and not have to run.
Yeah.
And fingers crossed.
You mean up it or down it?
Down.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, just you mean traffic-wise. Traffic-wise. The dirt part.
Yeah.
Just in terms of traffic.
I can't imagine 3 across going down that thing.
Yeah, I was watching a couple races where there was, because there are different specific lines, you know, with the people who go wide versus the people that cut it tight, and there was a lot of meeting at the center there for those couple of races.
Dicey. It might put it this way: whatever group I'm with, it's almost worth it to go hard up that hill just so you can be first down the descent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And that's I was talking to Matt Timmerman, who won the Masters 40-44.
He did, yeah.
The lesser known Timmerman,
right?
But the one with the more championships. He was really never under any pressure. He rode solo most of the race, but the way he saw it is that descent, you know, it's really a sprint to that descent. Even if the person in front of you is not riding it well, there is nowhere to pass on that descent. And after you come out of that descent, there's really only fast sections of course where it's going to be hard to, you know, like it's really going to be hard to take advantage of a mistake. You're just going to be pedaling really fast. You're going to get to the barriers, and then you do an uphill sprint, you know, and so it's kind of a sprint to that descent.
Yep. And just to remind everybody listening, we're doing all this before the race, so you can see how we did. Anything else we want to go over?
We could try to solve Pro CX again, but
no, I don't think we should do that. I should leave that for another year to see where we stand with that next year.
I gotta say, Meyerson's take on it was actually really well thought out.
I like that.
And I hope people go back, and if they haven't heard that episode.
Absolutely.
Well, I'd like to add one thing if we have the time, because you brought up the name. You know, there's a good chance that I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you tonight if it was not for Adam Meyerson, because even though I had an involvement with cyclocross long before he even like got his first license, in the middle of my involvement with the Nexa group and supporting their cross efforts, Adam asked me privately if I would do a sponsorship with him. And I didn't really give it much thought. I said, okay, that sounds like a good idea. Like, what do we do? So it ended up being like a 2 or 3 year gig where the first 2 years, he had his own private army, you know, based with me as the bike sponsor, his road team, Breakaway Couriers, as his main sponsor. And then he eventually, by the third year, I think, folded over and rode with us. But the energy that came with his involvement with me and mine with him exponentially triggered what I was already doing, to the point that, you know, I became really enthusiastic to watch him do well. He won collegiate nationals, I think, in 96 or 7 with my bike and Racing for UMass. And I felt really good about that because it made me feel like, oh, you know, like this giving back stuff is really cool, even though I had been at that point doing it for 15 years. So had he never asked me in the first place for like a private tier thing, I don't really know where my involvement with Cross would have gone with the small local group that I had, because his involvement, which rolled into like a larger involvement, was really the net that, you know, John Page eventually landed in. I think John Page had a year or two off, wanted to come back, and asked us on his way to Germany 1 year. I think that would have been 98. I have to like reverse engineer my calendar. He didn't have any gigs, so he wanted to, and we said, sure, yeah, we'd love to have you on our group. So that was the first of his 3 years with us. And before you know it, by the time John Page won in Napa in 2002, our team had won maybe 6 national championships, which in the scheme of things is not a lot, but in the short amount of time that it all happened, made me feel like, you know, like I've made the right decision. I walked away from road. I put all my energy as far as sponsorship into Cross, and I'll never look back. And everything we have now, I think, is a seed planted from those 3 or 4 years that, you know, would never have happened had Adam and I not crossed paths and had those conversations.
Yet again, Adam Meyerson saves cyclocross.
Yeah. And it's a good bookend with him racing his last professional nationals tomorrow. So, absolutely. Well, this has been a really great conversation. Richard, thanks so much for joining us. And Dan, great to have you back.
You're welcome, Bill. Thanks, Dan.
And there you have it. That was a fun conversation. Thanks so much to Richard for joining us on the show. You can check out everything about Richard Sachs at richardsachs.com. That is S-A-C-H-S. Also, find out about the Richard Sachs Cyclocross team at richardsachscyclocross.com. Our co-host, want to thank Dan again for coming back. You can follow along with Dan at Dan Chabanov on Twitter and Instagram. Definitely give Dan a follow on both of those platforms. You can also follow me at CX Hairs on both Twitter and Instagram. We're going to be back really soon with episode 19, which is going to be our post-US Cyclocross Nationals show. I'm going to be joined by the Cyclocross Network guys, Scott Diedenbach and David Palin, to do that show. Look for it soon and see you then. Later.